Schaefer, and I'd like to welcome you to Women of Wednesday. A few announcements before we get started. Ashley is doing a focus group. She's doing a public relations project, and she wants anyone who has used any Women's Center services to sign up an email and participate in that focus group, and we'll send that around now. Also, a few items before we get started. Please turn off cell phones and pagers, and please stay seated until 12:50 as a courtesy to our speaker. Also, if you could please fill out an evaluation form, we use this for future programming. Our session today is titled Pushing Back, Sex Education and Teen Pregnancy in Minnesota. Today's talk will discuss important social and health issues of teen sexuality, including teen pregnancy and the need for comprehensive sex education. It will examine the results of abstinence-only sex education, rates of teen pregnancies and STDs, effective sexuality education, and what type of sex education is, in fact, being provided in Minnesota schools. Our speaker today is Amy Marsicano. Amy Marsicano is the Director of Health Education for the Birds and Bees Project. She is responsible for developing the content of the Teacher Sexuality Education Residency Training. Amy has developed youth programming in the fields of sexuality, sexual violence prevention, and intimate partner violence. Amy has worked directly with incarcerated youth and women, youth surviving sexual assault, LGB and trans youth, and youth targeted by poverty and racism. We are very grateful to have her here with us today. Please join the Women's Center in welcoming Amy Marsicano.
Thank you, Erin, and thank you, Women's Center, for inviting the Birds and Bees Project to come and be a part of your Women on Wednesdays lecture series. It's an unusual invitation for us. Most of the work that we do is directly with youth, and then we also do a lot of work directly with teachers, so it's exciting to actually come to a university and be able to engage with all of you as students and citizens. I wanted to talk very quickly about what the Birds and Bees Project is. Can you all hear me, by the way? Is this okay? I'm Italian. I normally talk pretty loudly, but I want to make sure that you can hear with this. The Birds and Bees Project, I want to be very clear that we're actually a sexuality education program as a part of the organization Pro-Choice Resources. And our sexuality education program has been on the floor here in Minnesota for over 35 years, and we are a comprehensive sexuality education program. So we really come at the work from the belief that all young people deserve to have information and skill-building education that allows them to control the trajectory of their lives and control the experiences that they want to have happen in relationships, including healthy sexuality. So when we do work at the Birds and Bees Project and deliver curriculum, we follow skill-based and evidence-based curriculum, and then we also provide young people with all of their legal rights around STI testing, access to STI testing, HIV information, as well as the three legal options that all young people have when experiencing a pregnancy, which are open adoption, closed adoption, abortion, and parenting. So that is kind of our position that we come from when we do this work. What I am going to talk about today is a little bit, as Erin mentioned in the introduction, is a little bit about what are we talking about right now in the state of Minnesota in terms of the context of adolescent sexual health. And regardless of how we feel about comprehensive sexuality education, there is a pretty evidence-based road to protect and support adolescent health, and a piece of that is adolescent sexual health. So let's take a look first at what I'm talking about for adolescent sexual health. The primary question as I'm talking is, or what's called an enduring question, is sexuality education a human rights issue? So I'll keep returning to this question over and over as we look at what's actually happening for young people in the state of Minnesota. So currently in the state of Minnesota, just about half of young people are engaging in sexual intercourse before they graduate from high school. And that is a self-report based on the Minnesota Student Survey. The Minnesota Student Survey is administered through the Department of Education every 3 years and covers about 92% of school districts. So this data is the last set that we have, and again, it's from 2007. On the actual survey itself, it says sexual intercourse, and I want to be mindful and point out that we don't know what a young person is interpreting by the term sexual intercourse. We know that for LGBT youth, they've been completely excluded and left out in general around sexuality education. We know that many youth don't understand or may misconstrue sexual intercourse to only be vaginal penetration and not include oral sex. We also don't know how youth interpret anal sex, if that's sexual intercourse. Based on my work with high-risk populations and incarcerated youth and LGB and transgender youth, I would venture that this is very low, actually, the 49%, because we haven't done a very good job of being very explicit about what we're talking about when we say sexual intercourse. Teens in the United States, and again, this is not a Minnesota statistic, the second one here, this is a United States statistic, but teens contract 50% of sexually transmitted infections in the United States. So of the 18 million cases, 9 million were actually contracted by teens, even though they make up about 25% of the population. An average of 20 adolescent girls become pregnant each day in Minnesota. I always like to reverse that. We tend to feminize sexual health and pregnancy. So I like to turn that around and masculinize it or biologically put an equal share on what's happening from a reproductive perspective, which is the last bullet point. Boys and men impregnated 7,200 adolescent girls in the year of 2007. Teens with partners 2 or more years older are nearly 4 times more likely to experience a pregnancy. We're seeing a really large trend in Minnesota and nationally around what's called age-discrepant relationships. It's the idea that a person will engage in sexual behavior and in a relationship with someone well above their peer group. And technically, we measure that by 2 years or more. And again, there's a correlation between that age discrepancy and the chance of becoming pregnant. We also know that in the LGBT population, because of coming out dynamics and homophobia, that LGBT youth are more likely to engage in age discrepant relationships because they often go to bars to meet someone, or there's not a safe space at school to express who they are in a healthy relationship, and so they're often forced to go outside of school and go up the ladder in terms of age to engage in a relationship. So I just wanted to point that out, even though that's not specifically related to pregnancy. Homeless youth, GLBT youth, and chemically dependent youth are at higher risk for teen pregnancy and STIs. I think most of us can appreciate that being homeless is a lack of control around access, around choices. Many youth are trading sex for food, shelter, or money to survive. We also know that LGBT youth are 3 times more likely to be homeless in the state of Minnesota than their heterosexual counterparts. The U.S. Department of Justice estimates that 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys is sexually abused or assaulted before the age of 18. And so what that means from a sexuality education perspective is that we know that, you know, on an average classroom size of 25 or 30 students, that there's several students who have not been able to make the choice to be abstinent, quote unquote, or who have been exposed to sexual fluids from another person through a violent crime, or have been exposed to a viral shedding STI, such as HPV or herpes, based on a violent crime. Racial disparities in Minnesota for teen pregnancy and birth and STI HIV rates continue to persist. We're actually one of the Minnesota, unfortunately, and yet in a way that is addressable, is actually one of the highlight states in the country for disparities, for racial disparities around pregnancy and STIs. And I'll say a little bit more about what I mean by that in a couple of slides. You may have all seen the press of late on HIV, We are seeing an increase in HIV. It's the highest increase in HIV in 17 years in the state of Minnesota. You'll notice, I don't know if you can tell, but the males are like in a little box. So I'm just going to walk on the stage and show you a little bit. So this is males here. Hey, this is females. Unfortunately, this does not cover transgender folks or people whose biological, their bodies don't necessarily express or match their gender identity. We're not, unlike California and some other states, we're doing good work around capturing transgender population. Our state isn't there yet, although there's a lot of people on the ground working on that. So those populations are really missed in these statistics. But with HIV in particular, with males, there's a skyrocket, alarming skyrocket, and that's mostly young men having sex with men. So that's called YMSM, young men having sex with men, for HIV. Gonorrhea and chlamydia continue to be on the rise for teens in the state of Minnesota. Although these gonorrhea and chlamydia are, you know, treatable and they are curable, and cases can, once someone is infected with gonorrhea or chlamydia and they're treated, they can also get it, continue to get chlamydia and gonorrhea again and again. It's not something that, you know, someone can just get once. So we're concerned that ages 15 to 19 continue to see problems with these two in particular. I know that Children's Hospitals has actually made chlamydia testing an actual part of their protocol for teenagers who come through the clinic. And, oh, by the way, both of those can cause infertility and reproductive scarring, as well as pelvic inflammatory disease. Adolescent birth rate, I wanted to just very briefly talk about the racial disparities around adolescent birth rates in Minnesota. If you look at the column on your left, it's actually labeled white or of European descent or white. The purple or the darker column there represents the United States, and the kind of bluish turquoise represents Minnesota. So these are the rates. Again, not the numbers, but the rates. So what we have here is that if you go down, we've got African American as another set of columns, and you'll see that Minnesota's rate is actually higher in the African American population for birth rate as opposed to the United States. American Indian, if you can look at the large difference between Minnesota and nationally, under American Indian, Asian Pacific Islander is also much higher. And then Hispanic Latina is also much higher. Then I want to point out that although that's true, the majority of births in the state of Minnesota are white births because of how because of our population schematic. So even though we have these large racial disparities and discrepancies, when we're looking at numbers and when we're racializing teen pregnancy, actually the majority are still white adolescent girls and white white births. And that's what the this column here is representing, the actual number. So why these disparities? Researchers are still figuring this out. Disparities exist around sexual health and teen pregnancy in a similar way than other disparities around when we're looking at healthcare access, when we're looking at income level. So, for example, we still have concentrated areas of poverty. And in those concentrated areas of poverty, there's a lack of confidential and teen sexual health services. There's a lack of healthcare coverage or perceived access to healthcare, even if someone can go, based on some specially state-funded programs. We have a commitment from some schools around prevention programming. We also know that there is a dearth of prevention programming that's culturally relevant for specific populations. So, for example, in the Somali community, we cannot talk about birth control. That doesn't fit with the Somali community for culturally specific reasons. We need to be talking about birth spacing. Or, for example, in the Hmong population, it doesn't fit to talk about abortion. That goes against their clan system. Or, I'm sorry, I said abortion. I meant adoption. That actually goes against their clan system and the way that their culture is organized. And so there's a lot of specific examples like that that run all through the way that we do comprehensive sexuality education and talk about access and choices that really need to be reexamined and made to be culturally relevant to specific groups that we believe actually do continue to support disparities instead of actually becoming more inclusive in the work that we're doing. This is a comprehensive teen pregnancy puzzle that's put together by MOAP. They're a wonderful organization, Minnesota Organization on Adolescent Pregnancy Prevention and Parenting. And this particular puzzle shows all of the different pieces that would need to come together to actually prevent teen pregnancy. And if you can take a look, there's economic security up there, sexual violence prevention, academic support, responsible media messages, healthy youth development, chemical abuse prevention. So there's a wide amount of work that needs to be done on multiple issues to actually address and prevent teen pregnancy. What I'm talking about today mostly will be about comprehensive sexual health education, which is the piece on the far right there. But again, even if we did a great job at that, even if we had comprehensive sexuality educations at the state level, which we currently don't, even if we had every health teacher in the state of Minnesota teaching comprehensive health education for the number of hours that we know science has proven to reduce teen pregnancy and STI and HIV's transmission, we know that without all of these other pieces in place that drive towards access and information and support for the whole person, the whole child, the whole teen, that we will still have unintended teen pregnancy. This is a wonderful study that came out. This study was a study that came from MOAP, the organization I just referenced a moment ago on the last slide, as well as the Department of Education. And what this study did in 2007 is it actually interviewed teachers from across the state of Minnesota. And the drive of the the objective of the study was to find out exactly what's being taught in different schools for comprehensive sexuality education or any type of education addressing sexuality and sexual health. And what this study does not show, however, which is something very difficult for me, is that it doesn't show how something was taught and it doesn't show what was learned. How something was taught, what was learned, and how much time on that particular topic was spent. But it's still very helpful, and it's one of the only studies in the country that we have where there's no comp sex ed statutes on the books, and we're trying to figure out the rocky terrain of what's actually being taught in our school systems to youth. So what we have at the top is healthy relationships, and that's not a surprise to many of us. That's a wonderful piece to be talking about. Again, we don't know what curriculum's used to talk about healthy relationships, if LGBT kids are included in that, and kids with same-sex moms and dads, if those are included or not. Pregnancy, wonderful, 94%. STIs and HIV, 94%. That's not a surprise to us because the one statute that is on the books in the state of Minnesota for all teachers to teach is disease prevention, specifically around STIs and HIV, from a science perspective or an information perspective, not from a sexual behavior perspective. Reproductive anatomy, abstinence, 92%, sexual decision-making, 89%, and so forth. What I do want to take a look at is contraception, 85%, which we thought was relatively high. Sexual abuse, 83%. Media influence, 81%. Sexual orientation, 53%. And I don't know why abortion was covered, too, and I'm not sure why it didn't make my slide here. But abortion hovers right around sexual orientation as well. I'm sorry. I thought someone was... so, again, it's a great study for us to have. But the most important part of this study that we found is that the average health teacher who teaches sexuality education in the state of Minnesota spends between 11 and 15 hours on that content area in the grades of 7 through 12. So if you think of a business day Monday through Friday, we're looking at Monday, Tuesday, and maybe Wednesday or a part of Wednesday through the entire years of 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, and 11th and 12th grade. What's happening during that time from a developmental level? What's happening during that time around sexual identity, exploring sexual relationships, intimacy, sexual decision making, crushes, dances, all kinds of information? You know, a lot is happening in a young person's life during those years, and yet the amount of sexuality education that they're getting averages about 2.5 business days in that entire time. And what do parents think? A lot of people are really very surprised at this. I'm not surprised. This is a wonderful study that came out of the University of Minnesota, independent study from the Prevention Resource Center. They're nationally known. And they basically did a study with parents of teens in the state of Minnesota, asking these parents if they wanted comprehensive sexuality education for their teenager to be taught in a classroom setting at a school or not, and did that sexuality education, should it include contraception and should it be comprehensive? So I believe you all are, we're in District 6 right now? Okay, thank you. So, which it does have a reputation for being quite conservative, typically. But District 6 even, you guys, you have a 86%. So if you look here, District 6 all the way across, 86% of parents actually said they want comprehensive sexuality education taught at schools. And it's not that, you know, all around Minnesota, we've got 89% of parents, many, many districts, District 8, 7, 5, 4, and 3, District 2, 90%, and District 1, 94%. And so that doesn't really match up with our public policy right now at the state of Minnesota, that we have no sexual health education standards for teachers, and consequently no training for teachers and no funding for teachers. And I've already mentioned several times that there's no standards. And why that's so important in education is because when we have standards in education that teachers have to teach to at the state level, well, obviously, what enforces those standards but funding. And so we're looking at a lack of resources as well. I did mention the state of Minnesota already, that there is one statute around HIV and STIs. So what really happens then, you know, when the rubber hits the road, is that local communities are really deciding. And there's really a difference between formal decision makers and informal decision makers. There's a difference between influence and formal policy. And there's a difference between, transparent decision making around this, whether that's at the school board level or maybe less transparent. Sometimes a health teacher who feels very passionately about teaching contraception will go ahead and do it and may get some pull or some resistance from the principal because of fear about how the parents are going to react, especially if there's a condom demonstration happening in that classroom. But that's an informal. Here we have sexual education happening in that class with a teacher who believes strongly and wants to put that in curriculum, but that's not a decision that we have visibility to because the teacher's acting independently. It also goes the other way, where health teachers will choose not to deliver sexuality education, again, because there's no standards. One of our programs and projects I should mention, too, is funded by the Ford Foundation, and we actually just completed our first year of a teacher residency program where we actually train teachers for 4 consecutive days. It's about 32 hours of content, pedagogy as well as content, and then actually bring them in the classroom with us when we're interacting with youth, including incarcerated youth, to actually give them co-teaching and teaching experience around sexuality education because they don't get it as they become licensed health teachers. So the good news is that we definitely know what's proven to work We have been studying this for a very, very long time. Not me, but we have many, many, many different studies. You know, you're going to hear quite a bit, if you haven't already, about something called an SBP or an evidence-based curriculum. Okay, evidence-based curriculum or a science-based program. Those are programs that are comprehensive in nature, and the Obama administration has just approved over $110 million to support evidence-based pregnancy prevention curriculum. And they are proven through rigorous evaluation to reduce the risk of HIV, STIs, and pregnancy through the indicators of delaying sexual intercourse, increasing contraception use, increasing condom use, and the one that's not up here that should be is reducing number of sexual partners. So clearly those behaviors are would then, in fact, reduce the risk of HIV transmission and unintended pregnancy. I want to mention, too, that any evidence-based program, in order to make the list of being an evidence-based program, it actually has to change behavior of the students, not just knowledge, not just attitudes, and not just beliefs. So you're going to hear that probably if you follow sex ed in our field, knowledge, attitudes, beliefs, they're important to be addressing and talking about in the classroom, and when we're really looking at if a program is effective or not, we're looking at what behavior changes does a young person make as a result of the intervention. And why this is so important is because a person cannot change their behavior or understand how to do a behavior if they don't do a skill. So, for example, if someone just reads to me out of the joy of cooking, everything about how to make a souffle, and I never actually get in the kitchen, get the souffle pan, put it in the oven, check it out, try and understand exactly how much, you know, baking soda goes in, and actually practice that, what do you think my confidence level is going to be when I have to go and make a souffle for someone, and I've never actually done it? My confidence level is going to be very low, and chances are I'm going to say, no, I'm not even going to make that souffle, right? You'll know where I'm going in a second here. You already do? Are you guys with me? Okay. So one of the things in working with so many schools and teachers and parents, one of the things that we hear so much is, yes, you can talk about anything that you want. You can talk about anything that you want. But when we talk about actually doing an activity around sexual decision making and the nuances of really being in love with someone and wanting to delay or refuse sexual intercourse, or the nuances of really delaying, maybe, you know, being in a committed relationship and having a really serious, you know, love thing with this person, that's not typically what's talked about in sex ed. It's very cut and dry, like just refuse, delay, refuse, delay. But when we talk about really involving these students in an activity, sexual decision-making activities, that some of the scenarios are written, we allow the teens themselves to write the scenarios, then teachers get nervous, or administrators get nervous, or parents get nervous. When we talk about using, you know, actually doing, I'll do a vulva map, which is part of the SECA standard, Sexual Education Information Council of the United States, and they have a lot of standards for best practices in comprehensive sexuality education, and of course, mapping the vulva is very important because if females don't understand the difference between where their urethra is and where their vaginal opening is, it's a problem on a lot of levels. They come up to me and say, well, Amy, it means that, you know, if I urinate after sex, I won't get pregnant. And so we really have to take the time to map out the vulva. And then, of course, from a human rights perspective, we want to make sure that every single person knows what the clitoris is and that its function is pleasure. And we see that as a human rights issue. So while I say I would like to map the vulva and then demonstrate how to correctly use a dental dam for oral sex, teachers get nervous. Parents get nervous. Administrators get nervous. And we know that young people need to touch a dental dam. They need to touch that condom. They need to understand how it works in order to build their confidence and bring that confidence into their sexual relationships. It's called self-efficacy in the literature. So it's the idea that the more you practice something, the more confident you feel
And because of that confidence, that translates into a behavior change. So skills-based sex education is part of what comprehensive sexuality education is. So please don't take it lightly when some of us in the field say skills-based all the time. It's because we're advocates for actually letting students develop skills around sexuality and sexual health. That was a long story. Okay. All right. Very briefly, abstinence-only programs have not been affected, have not been shown to work through rigorous evaluation, including an independent study commissioned by the Bush administration called the Mathematica Report. And what they found, is that abstinence-only until marriage programs actually don't change behavior that reduces the risk of HIV, STIs, and pregnancy. They also deny representation of LGBT youth and families. And again, because birds and bees, we care about human rights and inclusivity and equality. That's another point for us that that we wouldn't want to go this route. But more importantly, regardless of how you feel politically, in terms of just the road to supporting adolescent sexual health, abstinence-only until marriage programs simply don't provide the skills that adolescents need to promote their sexual health. Comprehensive sex ed typically does focus on a broad range of topics. California put out a core competencies document for sexuality educators that includes gender identity, transgender, intersex, healthy relationships, the G-spot. I mean, there's so many different requirements. And of course, that's California. They're very, very progressive or liberal, depending on your point of view and interacting with that information. But there are comprehensive sex ed in general focuses on a very large range of topics and tends to embrace human sexuality or holistic sexuality with the whole person in mind, the idea that most people do feel their sexual being and want to express that in a variety of ways through a variety of relationships, and that that's actually health enhancing as a part of who we are as human beings. Comprehensive sex ed is skill building, and it also allows youth to focus on their own values. So we step back as educators and allow youth to actually reflect on some of the values that they have around sexuality by doing very specifically designed values clarification activities, and then we also allow them to see each other's values. So it is about values. Comp sex ed is. And as I said before, it's inclusive of all genders and sexual orientations. One thing about comprehensive sex ed that I think all of you know is that it always includes contraception, and it always includes information about dental dams, Plan B, so all contraception, not just contraception that's used prior to intercourse, but also emergency contraception, which prevents pregnancy. It doesn't cause abortion. Many comprehensive sex ed programs also do include information about the legal rights of young people to obtain health services, including abortion. I talked about this already, so I'm going to keep moving here. Here is the birds and bees critique of science-based programming, however, and comprehensive sex ed, is that although we are thrilled that the Obama administration has brought this money, approved this money for science-based programming, and we are thrilled that we know what works in terms of teen pregnancy and bringing down STI rates, we also feel strongly that disease prevention does not equal holistic sexuality or sexual health from a holistic perspective. So it's the idea that even if someone reaches the age of 20 without an STI, or someone reaches the age of 20 without impregnating a person or becoming pregnant themselves, that is not enough to say that that person is a sexually healthy person. So we do not believe that science-based programs should stand in place of holistic, comprehensive sexuality education for young people and adults that includes the much larger issues around intimacy, includes self-esteem, body image, gender identity, sexual orientation, families, community values, religion, body care, reproduction, and not just creating a family based on sperm and egg, but also the fact that we create families in lots of ways, adoption as well as artificial or alternative insemination. So comprehensive holistic sexuality education, I will not say that that's the exact same as a science-based program, although you will hear on NPR and other folks interchange those two because we're just so thrilled to finally have some money to do real teen pregnancy prevention. Good. Okay, I will go through some resources. These are some basic resources in our field that we use all the time that we love. The first one, Advocates for Youth, is fantastic. They have a live peer chat site where a young person can actually talk to someone that they select who looks like them, who may be from a community that they're from, as well as it has lesson plans, policy updates, action alerts. There's a lot of information from Advocates for Youth. They're the primary sponsor of the, the REAL Act, R-E-A-L, the REAL Act, which is another comp sex ed act. There's ANSWER, which is out of Rutgers University. They are also fantastic. A lot of information, policy-driven information, but they also have a specific resource for teens called Sex Etc., S-E-X, and then et cetera, and they also produce a magazine for teens. The Guttmacher Institute, clearly one of the most important resources for professionals in our field. I'm getting the sign here that, how many, 2 minutes? Oh, 5 minutes, okay. MOAP, I already talked about, Minnesota Organization on Adolescent Pregnancy Prevention and Parenting, Sex, etc., as a part of the ANSWER site. I guess I should have had those closer together for you. And then the Sexuality Information and Education Council of the United States, SECUS. There are a couple of really important resources that aren't on here that I'm just going to go ahead and give you right now. One is the Responsible, it's a coalition, and it's called the Coalition for Responsible Sex Ed. It's through MOAP, and it's a collaboration with many sexual health organizations, as well as Minnesota AIDS Project. So again, it's the Coalition for Responsible Sex Ed, and they have a listserv as well as action alerts that come out, and that's state-specific. And then the other one is GLSEN, Gay, Lesbian, Straight Education Network, GLSEN, G-L-S-E-N. They have fantastic information and resources for LGBT relevant information and lesson plans as well. I breezed through that. And I also wanted to just mention before I start taking questions, we can open up for some fun discussion, that I am here in place of a very valuable, wonderful staff person that we lost to the University of Minnesota. Her name's Amy Cadet. So she was the original presenter today. She worked for the Birds and Bees Project for a couple of years, and she's now at the University of Minnesota. So I jumped in, and I'm here in her place. And my name, as Aaron said, is Amy Marscano, and I'm the director of the program. So can I do one thing before we open it up for questions? Can I just read you some of the questions that we get from teenagers across the state of Minnesota? Yeah? Okay. So this is just a sample. And I'm in my 40s now, so I always have to kind of either have to have my reading glasses with me or pull this out a little bit. But these are actual questions that we have. So, does size matter? Is it true that girl can't get pregnant if she is on top? Can a girl get pregnant if you come in her anus? You can laugh, it's okay. But it's also quite sad, actually. I've heard, when you hit a girl from the back, you bust faster. Is that true? How come after you have a child, you are not sexually active? How likely is a... Oh, wait. Did I read that one? Yes. Okay. How likely is a girl to get pregnant if she's on the shot and you don't use a condom? Is it true when you are on your period you can't have sex? Can you get an STI in the throat? How? Why does she need a condom when her mouth on him? Is it okay to like the same sex? Do you have to be a certain age for the depot shot? And since I'm young, is it possible for me to die if I get pregnant again? People say AIDS come from... Here we go. This question always comes up. People say AIDS come from having sex with monkey. Is that true? Is it okay if I don't like boys? Is it okay if I don't like girls either? So that's just a sampling. Young people really, really want to know about sexual health. They want to know about sexual activity. They want sexual information. And I'm always surprised when we're interacting with them for maybe 3 or 4 lessons and they don't even have a relationship with us. And their hand will go up and they'll ask the most vulnerable and transparent questions, you know, that you've ever heard, you guys. And then they'll also write questions like the ones that I just read in a question box. And I think, oh my gosh, if they don't even know me, how is it that within, you know, the span of 2 hours, what is going on in the landscape of their life around who they can talk to, where they're asking these questions to me? I mean, I'm a sex educator, but what does it really say that they're asking these questions? And then when you layer on top of that the content of their questions, it's pretty startling, because that's really all of those questions have really basic answers. That's basic information that we would probably want most 6th or 7th graders to know factually. So, all right, I'm going to open it up. I didn't have much time. 40 minutes. This is a huge field, but you guys can ask me anything and we can hopefully have a rich discussion. Yeah. Great question. Yeah, so can we do it in a fun way?
Yeah.
All right. Stand up if you liked, your sex education. That's the first. Whoa. All right. Oh. All right. Thank you. So that's probably about a tenth. Here's the deal. We know that when students like you and they like the process, they learn more and they do better. So that's why I asked that question. Did you like it or not? How many people stand up if you actually had any sex education in high school? Wowza.
You said any.
Right. Now we're going to go a little further. All right. Stay standing. I'd like you to sit down if you never saw an actual condom demonstration in your class. And remember what we talked about in terms of skill building. Now, that's a really specific question that has to do with pregnancy prevention and STI for intercourse. But that tells me that that curriculum actually probably didn't do any other skill building either. Not just condom demo, but other skill building. Sit down if you were not taught about a young person's legal access, legal rights to sexual health care. So, for example, how to get an HPV test, how to get an HIV test. Okay, now we're getting... Okay, those are really basic. So in sex ed, we, you know, it's skill-based as well as about access. All right, sit down if you did not learn about unplanned pregnancy options such as adoption, or including all adoption, abortion, and parenting. Oh, good. Okay. All right. Sit down if you did not learn about sexual orientation and gender identity. All right. Now we're going to. Okay. So where did you go to school? Guy in the back there. Where? Rochester? Awesome. Olmsted County? Awesome. Did you like your sex ed? Okay. Great. How about you? Where did you go to school? Yep, I know Mounds View well. I know Gretchen's on over there. She directs all the health and sex ed. She's actually one of our teacher mentors, so she actually is a mentor for our teacher residency program. So we place teachers to learn from some of the Mounds View staff, including Heidi Shaw over there. So that's fantastic. She also is on the planning committee for the state school health educators conference every year. Gretchen's on is. So that's fantastic, Mounds View. Okay, how about you? Okay, where's that? How long was your sex ed unit? Full year of sex ed? Fantastic. What district are you in? Did you have to sign a parent permission form? Was it opt out or opt in? Do you remember? Okay. That's fantastic. All right. How about you, Aaron? Yeah.
It was covered, but there were some certain issues in that weren't covered as much. So, but we had a health class for one trimester, but about a third of the course was about sex ed. So.
Okay. That's great. It's a lot more than most folks get. So very good. So just for all of you who have had those experiences, a school district can make, I'm going to have you talk in the orange sweatshirt in a second. I know you sit down. But that school district may or may not have approved of that. It may have been the teacher or it may have been the school board, because it's just kind of all up in the air. That's part of the problem with not having those state standards. So even if a school board says we have no policy, that means one health teacher in one building can be doing sex ed and another teacher in another building doesn't do sex ed because there's no policy. So it's extra, E-X-T-R, you know, it's outside of policy. So then we get a real diversity in what's happening. And then in the orange sweatshirt, if you can share with us your school and...
I went to Roseville?
Great. Another great place. You have about four or five, a team of four or five teachers there. Fantastic. That is fantastic. There's a couple of things that are so exciting about that. One is that in the teen pregnancy prevention field, we know that any youth serving or youth development program actually has similar results in reducing teen pregnancy. So the idea that as a high school student, you went and actually contributed to your community by talking to seventh graders, that's called service learning. It's another form of youth development. Those programs are really promising in our field, but also that you're actually talking about prevention and education to seventh graders about HIV specifically is fantastic. But so the diversity here in this room was pretty glaring. We had people kind of all over the map. Are most people from Minnesota? Raise your hand if you're from Minnesota in here. Okay, yeah. So I think it's pretty clear what kind of problems could ensue, or we have the outcomes now of some of, you know, what it means when people are getting really different education around health and then around sexual health specifically. I am going to go back to that question, is sexuality education a human rights issue? I think it's an important question to ask. There's not necessarily always an answer, or that answer might change over and over again, but I think it's an important question when we're looking at other topics that are covered in school-based education that are around human rights, but for some reason when we attach sex or sexuality, we tend to shy away from a human rights framework, even when we're talking about HIV, and even when we know that when someone becomes pregnant at a young age, what that means for that person's life trajectory in terms of poverty, not one in five actually being able to accomplish a college degree by the age of 29. So there's some real implications there, depending on that person's support, culture, and family as well, but that we continue to kind of tie sex ed to disease and health. And we're at the Birds and Bees Project and through our the program that we're doing through Ford, we're wanting to kind of expand that a little bit and talk more about human rights with this issue. Other That was fun to do that little stand-up activity. Questions for me about some of the content that I covered or anything else just off the top of your head or something that you're wanting to ask around sex ed? Oh, you guys can't be that shy. Yes. That is a great question. So she asked, when you talk about culturally specific resources, for example, Somali and Hmong populations, what are some resources? We are so fortunate to have the Minnesota International Volunteer organization. They did an entire project on sexuality education within the Somali community, and they've put out about 5 different DVDs that educate, that can do direct education through video. They've also been used, some pieces I believe have been used for some PSAs, but actually doing that work in community, that's an outstanding specific organization. Planned Parenthood has a Hmong educator, and the YWCA off of Lake Street in Midtown also has a program for Hmong students. In St. Paul, there is, I'm trying to think of the, there's some collaborative work that's done with Hmong-specific organizations working with sex ed people to deliver more relevant sexuality education as well. Yeah, is that zero? Okay. All right, well, thanks for letting me come in, you guys.